Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This is David Lichtenstein. This week, we're going to be speaking in Halacha about Sukkos. We're going to be speaking to Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Charlap. He's an importer of Esrogim for 40 years, and he has 150 locations that he supplies with Esrogim. He is an Esrog expert. He's going to be talking about what to look for when buying an Esrog, what's important, and what is the fellow selling it to you doesn't really get it. What's the minimum to be yotze? You know there's a esrogim that I spread out on the table. It says $20 for an esrog and a little set. And then you know somebody who's spending $250 or $400. What's yotze? What's the minimum? What's hither? What's the difference between the different types of esrogim? There's the Greek esrogim. There's the Taman esrogim. Each one is the miyuchas. There's the chazinish esrogim. There's Lubavitch. You have the esrogim of the badat, etc., etc. Will the real esrog please stand up? What does a heksha on an esrog box mean? You always get that. You see, oh, it has a heksha. It's great. Listen to what Rabbi Charlap says about heksha. This will surprise you. It surprised me.
Tell everyone, if you're not sure, bring the esrog to your rav. We don't give I have Rav Yaakov Meirstad, and he gives the hechsher on all our esrogim. And I met with him actually last week in Eretz Yisrael. I just came back. And he basically told me very clearly, you know, we're giving the hechsher on the pardes, that it's not Morkov, that, you know, that they keep Arla, they keep all the halachas. Next year is Shemitah, that's a whole nother discussion. And basically, they're not giving the hechsher on the specific esrog. When you pick an esrog and you want to know if it's kosher, the best thing is to bring it to your rav, if you want to be 100% sure.
Did you hear that? You've been wrong all along, as I have been. The hechsher has nothing to do with the esrog. It's on the pardes. So this is the man who knows esrogim. Let's get educated. We're going to have Reb Shlomo Francis, expert on sukkah. He's mechabes sfarim. He speaks all over. That Gudda had him they just finished sukkah. He went around. He gave shurim on it for them. What to be careful about when making a sukkah? Mats. People are using mats. Are all mats kasha? Are some mats kasha? Are there halachas if a mat flies off? What you're allowed to do? What about trips on chalamoid? Can you go someplace? You want to go to Great Adventure? There's no sukkah over there. Are you allowed to go and eat outside the sukkah or not? Etc., etc. Many halacha sukkah, hilcha sukkah that you'll find fascinating. Before we go to our guests, I want to say a thought on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, everybody knows who blows the shofar. We blow the shofar. Tikku b'chay the shofar. The makra says tkiya. But if you look in the psukim of Shofaris, a whole different story unfolds. Look at the 10 psukim. What does it start with? It says, Kakosiv b'sayra secha. Vehi b'yay mashwishi, koil shofar chazak ma'id. Who was blowing the shofar by Matan Torah? It wasn't Moshe and it wasn't Aaron. Right, it's the shofar of Kaviyachal. Vehi koil ha-shofar ha-holech v'chazak ma'id, Rashi says, when a person blows it, it gets weaker. Kaviyachal shofar keeps getting stronger and stronger. But then again, you have the tkiyas of Klal Yisrael. B'chatzoytzreis v'kol shofars, another pasuk in shofars. Hariu lifnei ha-melech Hashem. This is Klal Yisrael. Tikku b'chay de shofar. Hallelu b'seik ha-shofar. Again. But then what does it go back? Go back to the tkiyas of Kaviyachal. V'Hashem aleyem yiroya. V'Hashem aleikim b'shofar yiska. L'asad lavei v'halach b'saris teiman. Tka b'shofar gadol cheruseinu. These are the tkiyas of Kaviyachal. I didn't see anybody beyond it on the tkiyas of Klal Yisrael. And is the tkiyas of Kaviyach. What is the message? So what are the tkiyas? The tkiyas ought to be mamlech Kaviyachal, and they're also shayalu zuchreinechem lefanei l'toiva. What is it underlines? Think about zuchreinus. Think about the events of the world. We often see them in our own myopic way. You see an event, and you look at it, and it's awful, or it's great. You know, years later, you can look back at that same event, and what you thought was awful was actually pretty good, or maybe even wonderful. And the thing that you thought was wonderful was actually quite awful. I mean, we've seen that. The easiest case is Shidduchim, but et cetera. Many times in our life, if we're honest, we see that. And look in the Torah, how two different views, Kaviyachal's view of the world and Adam's. It says, Yaakov sends Yosef to go search for his brothers. And he's lost. V'yimtze'eyuish, he doesn't know where they are. He's lost, he's wandering. The man says, we'll call him Label. Where are they? Tell me where. So he says, it says five words. So Yosef goes down, they sell him. The future of the world changes. The Jewish nation is born. everything comes from us, Kal Yisrael. World changes. Label went home that night, and his wife said to him, "No, anything happened interesting at work today while you were watching the sheep, whatever he did as business?" "Nah, nothing, regular day." Really? Ol Chuda Saina was a regular day? I'll give you another example, a Rosh Hashanah example. Imagine you're an environmentalist or an animal lover, and you're standing there taking a walk, and you see the most amazing spectacle. You see a mountain goat, a ram, a great ram, but it's the most beautiful in history. It has not 6 points, not maybe a 15, a 20-point set of antlers, huge, and it's beautiful, and it's stuck in a thicket. But you're admiring it, and suddenly you see a man running towards it with a knife, Eloi shel Yitzchak. And the animal lover is screaming at the top of their lungs, "Ram, run for your life, run!" He's whistling and hanking and screaming. And Lyle's stuck in the thicket, and Avram comes and it shechts it. So look at the two narratives. The narrative of the shofar of Kaviyachal, the Zachronis of Kaviyachal, right? Where he interprets, what is it? This environmentalist went home, and he had mamish post-traumatic stress disorder. That night, he had to drink a whole bottle of bourbon to fall asleep or take whatever other drugs. Why? He cannot believe the tragedy that he saw. The most beautiful, incredible, lithe, stunning, perfect ever, that he's ever, and truly so, shechted. What a terrible disaster this is. What's the other side of this? This aisle has been waiting there. What does it say? Asara dvarim nivru ben hashmashes, before creation, one of them before creation, and the bakesa liyem chayenu, right? We're talking about, was what? Was Eloi shel Yitzchak. It's in that thicket waiting for over 2,000 years, waiting for this moment to become the carbon, you know, Eloi shel Yitzchak, the shofar, the tikkun of Klal Yisrael, the tikkun of the Bria is through this, the shofar of Eloi shel Yitzchak. Two narratives. So there's the shofar of Kaviyachal, the shofar that starts all the way in the beginning. The first shofar. And what is the shofar? Hoylech v'chazek. When is this hoylech v'chazek going to? Vashem melekim b'shofar yiska v'holech b'salech tema b'sareis temen t'kabe shofar galuch harasenu. The endless view. And then there's the view of the shofar of man. And what is it, the tefillah of the shofar? How could we, our shofar, this coil of our shofar, become one with the coil of the shofar? But he coil a shofar holech. How does our shofar align that we could, in our shofar, we could see the tamlichuni aleichem, the merge, you know, like when you have a camera and it's a very fuzzy view and you turn it left and you turn it right and it gets sharp? How does our coil shofar, how do we get it to merge with the coil shofar of Hashem aleim yiroeh v'yatzah kebarak chitzay v'Hashem aleikim b'shofar yiska? How could we see Bria, hear the sound of the shofar of Hashem, see the ratzon of Kaviyachal in our lives? And what have the Chachamim of past generations told us? The word olam, the world, also means milashin helam, hidden. For Kaviyachal's reasons, he hides himself, he's behester in this world. But sometimes, if we're on our toes, we could see glimpses of him. And we see glimpses of Hashem, glimpses of God, and we say, wow, he winked at me there. He did something. He revealed himself in some really, for those who are discerning, at that point, if we're aware, our shofar and the shofar of Kaviyachal, the shofar of the Rabbeinu Shalom, the two koilos merge. And you know what that is? That's really Tkiyah Gedayla. We're finished with the Shvarim. We're finished with the Truas. There's the Tkiyah Pshuta. Our Tkiyah and Kaviyachal's Tkiyah join. When we see that glimpse, that's right. That year, we blew the Tkiyah Gedayla. We were Mekayim Tam Lechuni Alechem with this Tkiyah. This is what the Hachamim of prior Dairis have revealed to us. And Kavanas HaShofa. Before we go to our guests, I want to say a story. It's an old Hasidish story that I think it's a very beautiful story and has a powerful message. All of us need chasim, right? We're coming to the Yom HaDin. We're saying slichas. Let me tell you a story. Everybody in the world heard of the Heilige Zedechaiva. Reb Tzvi Hirsch B'Zedechaiv was called the Sar Beis Hazayir, considered maybe by Hasidim the greatest of the Mekubalim of the Rebbes. And when he said Slichas, he was Mekadosh Atzmai with Esek Kedushas before he said Slichas. And one time he looked into heaven and he heard a voice and it said, Reb Tzvi, you think your Slichas are so great? There's a Yid in Sasev, his name is Moshe Leib. His Slichas, they are the Slichas that open up the gates of heaven. So the Holy Zedechaiva, he heard that. He said, wow, I'm going. So he traveled from Poland all the way to the Ukraine, to Sasev. And he comes to the city of Sasev and he says, there's a Yid here, Moshe Leib. They said, yeah. He says, where does he live? Over there. Where does he daven sleep? Where does he say his Slichas? People look at each other. I don't know. We don't know where he says his Slichas. So the Chayva says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to right outside the house. And when he comes out in the morning, I'll follow him. Next morning, he goes there, 5 o'clock, early before Ralais, waiting and waiting, nothing. He says, maybe I have to come earlier. Next night, he goes there. He goes at 3 o'clock in the morning. Sure enough, 4 o'clock in the morning, the door opens. And to his surprise, he never saw the Sasava. He says, somebody dressed like a Russian peasant comes out wearing a long coat, carrying a sack and a hatchet over his shoulder. Wow, this is strange. What does the Dechaiva do? From the distance, he follows. It's the beginning of the Russian winter. Very cold in the Ukraine already, even in October. And he sees him walking. And he goes into the forest. To his amazement, he starts chopping wood. He's chopping. He puts a pile of wood, takes out the sack, piles all the wood into the sack, puts it over his shoulder, starts walking. Still dark. It's getting earlier though. It's getting later in the morning a little. You know, the night is getting shorter. He follows him. He comes to the outskirts of the town and it's like a ragged, ramshackle, broken down house. And he knocks on the door. The Chaiva looks in through the window. What a mess. There's a lady there with 3 kids. They're all huddled under a blanket. There's no fire. It's freezing. Knocks on the door. He says, who's there? Ivan, the wood chopper. Lady says, I have no money. Don't worry. You'll pay me some other time. Can I come in? Yeah. He goes in. There's a fireplace there. Opens up his sack. Takes out the wood, starts piling it up, makes a big pile next to the fireplace, the extra wood, takes some kindling, lights it. The fire catches slowly. The little house starts filling up with warmth, with warm air, with beauty of the fire. He says, you'll pay me sometime in the future. I'll come back when you have money. Walks out of the door, closes the door, puts the sack back in his over his shoulder, the empty sack, picks up the axe, puts it over his shoulder and starts walking. And he sees the Sasava look up to the heaven, and the first streaks of dawn are shining in the sky. The first rays of dawn. And he looks and he hears the Sasava start to say, The Sasava is saying Slichas. And as the Chaiva understood, why the Slichas of the Sasava were considered the holiest Slichas in Klal Yisrael. All of us know somebody who could use some help. Maybe that's how you and I should say our Slichas this year. Let's go to our riddle of the week. Okay, last week's winners. We have a lot of winners. We have Shlomo Sabovich, Michael Stein, Chaim Hildesheim, Jack Stroh, Eliezer Berman, Moses Eshkenazi, Miriam Weintraub. Oh, the women are also getting the riddles. Okay, Micha Friedland, Yitzchak Kapetis, Nossin Nussbaum, Elio Zak, Levi Silman, Miriam Dembitzer. Second one, Menashe Steele. We have very smart women here. Aryeh Polak, A. Zemel, we don't know what A stands for. It could be Ahuva, it could be Avram. David Wolfson, Adam Flew, David Brodsky, and Moshe Hecht. Okay, they'll all receive something. Now let's go to our riddles of the week. 2 riddles. You'll use them for Rosh Hashanah. So Shulchan Aruch says, in Siman Tavkuf Tzadik Beis of Gimel, Lo yasiach lo hatekeya v'lo hatzibur. You shouldn't. No speaking. Everybody knows during Tzkiyas. From the beginning to the end, look at the Mishnah Berurah, no speaking. The Shulchan Aruch paskins by Bedikas Chametz and Siman Taf Lamed Beis of Aleph, like the Rosh, that once you started making Bedikas Chametz, There's no issa to speak b'emtza b'dika. It's not a hefsek. It's better not to, but it's not a hefsek. Right, so the question is, why by Shofar does it say you shouldn't speak to beginning from the beginning till the end, not to make a hefsek? And why by Bedika, that once you picked up one piece, so the brach has something to be chal on, afterwards there's no hefsek? Say the same thing here. Once I heard one set of tekiyas, I'm yoytza, what do I care anymore? If afterwards, once it has something for the bracha to be chal on, there's no hefsik till the end. By bedika, if you picked one piece, there's something for the bracha to be chal on, you still need the rest of the bedika. You didn't finish your house. Not like you were mekayim the whole mitzvah. It's just the bracha was chal. Same thing here. The bracha was chal on one tekiya. That's riddle number one. Riddle number two. The Ramah Paskins in Siman Tov Reish Siv Beis. The machlokes is Rosh Hashanah Yom HaRichter, one day, 2 days, he says, not to have a suffix, what do? You take a pre-chadash, you take a new fruit, or a new beged, and you put it there by Kiddush, you say a Shechiyanu, you also have Kavanah on the fruit. Question is, by Kiddush B'Leil Shabbos, by regular Kiddush, if somebody would make a Shechiyanu in middle of Kiddush before they drank the wine, what would you say? It's a hefsek. What does this bracha have to do with Kiddush? So manashach. If alt Kiddushas Hayyim, you need the pre-chadash of Adas on a hefsek. But the Ramah says you do it also safik. And it's sad that you don't need the pre-chadash, you don't need the shechiyanu for the yom. It's a total hefsek. So just like by a regular kiddush, you would never do it, because you make a hefsek in the kiddush. Here, and it's sad that you don't need the shechiyanu, the chayra, you're not yaitse the kiddush, you have a hefsek between the kiddush and the bracha. So how could you possibly make the Shechiyanu, according to this, before you make the Bayer Priya Gafen, or before you drink, either way, depending on what your minig is? By regular Kiddush, it's a hefsek. Why on the other tzad, you don't need it? On Rosh Hashanah, isn't it a hefsek? Those are our two riddles. And whoever gets the answer, of course, we will continue. We will send them a gift. I'm not going to get a chance to, the end of all the our shiur this week, to vinch everybody in a good gebench jur, so let me do it now. I vinch on, I wish everybody who listens a good gebench jur. It should be Yumalehit Mishash Kadosh Baruch Hu Mishalis Libchem Latoiva. Anybody who I may have offended, and you know, when you take positions, you're always offending somebody. You know, can I and her with Kol Yisrael, there's many days. I would like to ask your forgiveness. And any of my interviewees, if I've interviewed anybody and they got insulted, I would like to ask them for forgiveness.
To leave a message, call 732-806-8700 and press number 2. Or email at info@headlinesbook.com.
Let's go to our guests.
Joining us from New York is Rabbi Yaakov Chalap, is really Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Chalap, and he is an enikel of Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Chalap, who's been importing esrogim for over 40 years. He's a partner in Pardesim. He actually does the categorization, it's called the Miyun in Hebrew, of the different qualities, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, ABC. He distributes thousands of esrogim in America. He has over 150 locations. He certainly would qualify as an expert by any standards. Welcome, Rabbi Chalap.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe, here's the shaila. What's a minimum esrig, and where do you go into the gedder of hiddur? Like, when you go to the supermarket, Erev Sukkot, there's trays of esrigim lined up. You could probably buy one for $10, sets for $20. I don't know. I'm just guessing. I'm picking some minimal number. Are you yaitzu with those? Like, walk us through. What are you yaitza with? What's a mechudadik esrig? How much how much are the best esrigim go for? Give us a little bit of an education.
Okay, so esrigim, like you mentioned, can sell. They're not necessarily sold in the supermarkets. They're sold like more in the street. You could go to Bar Park, 13th Avenue, and see thousands of esrigim Erev Sukkot. Like you say, for maybe $20 a set. They're selling them in Queens on Main Street and throughout the United States. An esrig, typically, most esrogim are sold for a lower price, from $20, $30, $40, $50 in that range. And the esrogim that you hear that are being sold for $100, $200, $300, they're really very minimal. There's probably less than 5% of a pardis that sells for more than $100. So most esrogim are being sold on the lower end, and that's really what's left over that you can find in the street on Erev Sukkos. But if you want a nice esrog, you have to go to the meicher like right after, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Pretty much after Yom Kippur, there's not too many nice ones left.
You categorize thousands of esrogim for 150 dealers. What is an aleph? What is a beis? What is a gimel?
An aleph esrog has to have a nice gidol, relatively clean on top. People look for the cleanliness on top. The top third, the top half is the most important. If it has something a little blethel on the bottom, then people look away more. But the top, they want the top to be clean. So an esrog that's completely clean, has nice shkiyas and blitas, is a nice gidol, that's an aleph esrog. And, you know, an esrog could always be nicer based on the next one that you see. But that's basically, if it has a little bit of a blethel on the bottom, but it's a nice shkiyas and blitas, nice gidol, then it's a beis. And if the gidol is not so nice, then it falls into the gimel category.
So it sounds to me like it's the gidol that's the overriding driver here. And after that comes, you say, the nekiyas, the cleanliness. Give us general pricing for an aleph, for a beis, and for a gimel.
So a real aleph esrog, like an aleph plus esrog, could go upwards of $100. You know, they start at $100. If you really, really have a beautiful gidol and absolutely clean, you could go for $200-$300. There's stories of a esrogim being sold for $1,000, but truthfully, there's not many like that. And there's a lot of them from the Yanava type. I don't deal with those, but those sometimes come a little cleaner. They don't have the shkiyas and blitas like the Eretz Yisrael Dikah esrogim, so sometimes they grow a little bit cleaner. And the cleanliness is a big factor, obviously, in esrogim.
And a beis, so an aleph would be 100 plus. A beis is between what and what?
So when I categorize esrogim, I do it differently than other people. I pick up the esrog. If it's an esrog that I think could sell for $25 to $30, I put it in the gimel category. If it's $50, $60, $70, I'll put it in the beis. And if I think it could sell for 100 plus, we put it in the aleph category.
Where does a pitim? I didn't hear you mention a pitim. For a lot of people, that's very important, especially if you see them.
Right. So the pitim is interesting. In America, they teach you if it doesn't have a pitim, the esrog is pasul. That's what they teach you in school. But what they don't teach you is that if it grew without the pitim, then it's perfectly okay. But the question is when the pitim fell off. Sometimes I've seen esrogim, you're about to cut the esrog and the pitim is just very dried out and about to fall off, and people don't like those esrogim. So they want to make sure that the pitim fell off in the beginning of the growth cycle. A lot of people are makbid. That's why a lot of people are makbid to take esrogim with the pitim, because they don't know if the pitim fell off before. If the pitim breaks after the esrog is cut, you could usually tell. But if the pitim fell off just as the esrog is being cut, or right before or right after, sometimes it's hard to tell.
Yeah, because it has to do with there's an indenture or not. Is that correct?
Right. So the earlier the pitim fell off, usually the more the indenture is. And
right.
When it fell off later in the growing cycle, sometimes you see a little piece sticking up. That's correct.
That's what the price can make. So how much do you pay for a premium for a pitim? Let's go to aleph esrog. If an aleph esrog is a nice gidol, base would be 100. Now it has a nice pitim. Or what does that add on to it?
So pitims typically go for more because there's less nice esrogim with pitims. It's supply and demand. You know, it depends on the year. Sometimes you have more bali pitims and call it balap. Sometimes you have more pitims. But typically, a nice pitim goes for more than a bali pitim, typically.
And I'm give me just a ballpark. What does it add on to the cost of an esrog?
A nice pitim could go for $150, $200 if you really want a nice esrog. Then you have mufkharim again. It could go for $300, $400, but very, very small percentage really sell for that price.
Some people want a gartel on their esrog.
Correct.
Want to tell the ilum what that is?
Sure. So esrogim grow all different shapes and sizes, as people realize. The ksidim, a lot of people who are want a gartel with a. By the way, a gartel without a pitim is very. Most people don't go for such an esrog, but they like a gartel with a pitim. To get a gartel with a pitim that has a symmetrical shape, and it's clean, is really one in a thousand. That's why they go for so much money.
How much do they go for?
A nice gartel could go for $200-$300 if you really find. I mean, there are plenty of gartels out there, but they're usually not clean. To get a clean esrog and a gartel
and a pitim
is difficult to find. And we put them away. I usually from every 1,000, I maybe find 20 like that. Mm-hmm. It's a very small percentage.
And with the $25 to $30 esrog, are you yaitzer the halacha?
So the answer is, I tell everyone, if you're not sure, bring the Esrog to your Rav. We don't give the I have Rav Yaakov Meir Shteren, he gives the Hechsher on all our Esrogim, and I met with him actually last week in Eretz Yisrael, I just came back, and he basically told me very clearly, you know, we're giving the Hechsher on the Paradis, that it's not Morkov, that, you know, that keep Arla, they keep all the Halachas, next year is Shemitah, that's a whole other discussion. And basically, they're not giving the Hechsher on the specific Esrig. When you pick an Esrig and you want to know if it's Kosher, the best thing is to bring it to your Rav, if you want to be 100% sure.
I think that's really important for people to know, that when they see on the box a sticker with the Rav's name, it's not on the Esrig, it's on the Pardis.
Correct.
I think 99% of people don't know that.
They write correct, but they that is
and they don't write it on the label either, which is astonishing.
They do sometimes when they give a letter to the Baal HaPardes that they're giving on the growing of the Esrogim.
Yeah,
but the
Badat Hechsher on the box does not say that. Talk to us about the difference between the Moroccan Esrig, the Yanavar Esrig, Badat, the Taimin Esrig, Taimin with the Pitim, Chazenish. Go through these different categories of Esrogim.
Okay, so there's many different types. As you mentioned, there's the Esrogim from Morocco, Taimini, there's Chazanish Esrogim. What are the differences? People really don't understand what the differences are. I deal mostly in Eretz Yisrael Esrogim and Chazanish, and a little bit Moroccan. Of course, next year Shemitah is going to deal more with Moroccan. By the way, just a side point, you know, people are concerned because after Rosh Hashanah is Shemitah, but all the Esrogim for this year are cut before Rosh Hashanah. There is Moroccan Esrogim. A lot of people hold that Moroccan Esrogim are the quintessential Esrig because it's not Morkov. Why? Because they were very primitive there and they did not know how to be Markiv, so that's the original Esrig from Morocco. A lot of people hold of that. A lot of people take Chabad Esrogim. A lot of people take Calabria Esrogim from Italy. It's all based on Minhagim, and you know, you can't start off with Minhagim. I respect everybody. If somebody tells me they want a Yanava or a Moroccan, then there's no take. Follow your Minhag.
Some people believe that a Moroccan Esrig is cleaner, is a nicer Giddel very often?
So you know what? It's interesting. I've been to Morocco several times. And I can tell you that the Esrogim there in general are not cleaner than the Eretz Yisraelic Esrogim. It's just that most people who take a Moroccan Esrog want a clean Esrog, so they really don't ship a lot of the lower grade Esrogim here. So that's really, so people think the Moroccan Esrogim run cleaner, but most of the Moroccan Esrogim are not usable.
And what about the Giddel? Some people believe they have a nicer Giddel.
On the Moroccan Esrogim?
Yeah.
So again, because they're really only sending the nicer Esrogim on the Moroccan Esrogim. Most of the cheap Esrogim stay there and they discard them.
So what is the Messiah on Moroccan Esrogim?
It's that they grew them hundreds and hundreds of years ago and it was very primitive and they didn't know how to be Markiv. That's what I heard. Years ago there was no Hechsherim even on the Moroccan Esrogim. Today they have Hechsherim, but based on the timing that it was such a long time ago and they didn't know how to be Markiv, they didn't have they didn't know how to do it. That's what I heard, why people rely on it.
And so now let's talk about the Yanav Esrig, which is very similar.
Right. So the Yanav, again, similar to Moroccan. People have a Masoira to use Yanav Esrigan. A lot of the Chabad they use Yanav Esrigan. And those do run a little bit cleaner. But again, they're only shipping the better ones. It's interesting. I spoke to people from Italy. I don't really deal with those Esrigan. They told me that they go to the field and they show the growers or the cutters which Esrogim to cut. Not like in Eretz Yisrael where they're cutting all the Esrogim and then we make the categorization. They're paying for each Esrog that they cut off the tree. So if it doesn't have a nice shape, you can't tell the cleanliness so much on the tree because you have to clean them, but you could tell the Giddel, that you could tell. They tell them which Esrogim to cut. So again, they're bringing mostly only the nice Yanava, so people think the Yanava Esrogim are much nicer.
And they're much more expensive. Aren't they much more expensive, the Yanav Esrog?
Yes, because they're only bringing the nice ones. So it has a shame that they're more expensive. The nice Eretz Yisrael Esrogim are also more expensive.
But, and I believe the Mishneh Berurah writes that you should only use Yanav. Here's the Lashon of the Mishneh Berurah. He says, "Hi, I say makim yemuchsik miyamim kadmainim sheesrogeim einim rekavim." Very interesting. He brings...
I just discussed this last night with somebody. Our Esrogim, 40 years ago, we used to write Becheskas Vadai Bilti Murkavim. And then someone told me, you don't need the word Vadai. It's Becheskas Bilti Murkavim. Every Esrog that we use today is pretty much Becheskas Bilti Murkav. Yeah. It's really impossible to, you know, to say it's everything is becheskas.
Now, by the way, he's bringing it from the Chassam Sofer and others. I mean, I'm no expert in this, but do the Yanava look different than the Israeli Esregim? And the Chazon Ish, is it?
100%. They look different. Even the Chazon Ish, every Esreg has its look. And I'll give you an example. The Eretz Yisrael Dik Esregim have those skias and blitas, the regular skias and blitas. The Chazon Ish Esregim, some of them, like they have from Braverman, Kivalevich, Lefkovich, you'll see they have those starker skias and blitas, like they're more pronounced. They're smaller. I happen to like them. Not everyone goes for that, but they're more like smaller skias and blitas and more pronounced on the Esreg. And then the Yanav Esroigim are more glopped, they're more smooth. So they don't have, you know, those big skias and blitas. And sometimes that's why they run cleaner, because the skias and blitas always the create problems.
Okay. Talk to me about the Badatz Esroigim. Where do they come from?
So the Badatz, there's no such thing really as a Badatz Esroig. The Badatz gives the Hechsher on the Esroigim. And there's only a few Pardesim, for some reason, in Eretz Yisrael, that they give a Hechsher on. They give it on Chabad Esroigim, on Grosses Field, they give on a few Pardesim, they give Badatz Eda Charedis, and those have the Shem became a name like Badatz Esroigim. But it's just the Hechsher, one of the Hechsher.
So what did the Badatz rely on to give a Hechsher on these? Was giving that the Safik is Mesaira, Murkav, and let's say the Chassam Sofer said the Yanava the best, etc. What did Badatz decide to put their impetur on?
Well, I know for sure. I've gone around with the Badatz to the Pardesim. They look to make sure that they're really not Morkov. And you could tell if an Esrig tree was...
But the cow left the barn a long time. I mean, it could have been Morkov 500 years ago. By the time Chabad brought its Hechsher, brings its Hechsher, it's not going to be very helpful.
I'll tell you a secret that people don't know, that they used to sell Morkovim in the United States after the State of Israel was established in the 1950s and 1960s. They sold Morkovim here. They were called Stam Esroigim. Now, in the 70s and 80s, they stopped because Baruch Hashem, there was a lot of Esroigim they didn't need to. But there was one time that they did sell Merkavim. So that's what the Badatz came in and made sure that they stopped that, and they don't do that anymore.
But the Badatz, you don't know where the provenance of the Badatz originally, where they're coming from.
You'd have to speak to the Badatz actually.
Okay. What about the Taman Esregim? How are they different, let's say, than the Yanav or the Moroccan?
So again, the Taman Esregim, there's people that started a sort of a movement to everyone should take Taman Esregim. They believe that that's their Messiah, to use Taman Esregim. Now again, 50, 60 years ago, there wasn't that many. They planted more now, and there's more on the market. I've never dealt with them. I've always dealt with Eretz Yisrael Dik Esroigim. And interestingly enough, they plant Esroigim in Florida and California as well. And there's a lot of people that use the California Esroigim. But in my experience, people want Esroigim from Eretz Yisrael. And that's why I've stuck with that over the years.
Okay.
That's what people really request.
And the Chazon Ish Esroigim, which I think are also a little more of the pricier Esroigim, what's their provenance and where are they getting them from?
Right. So the Chazon Ish Esroigim was, everyone knows the Chazon Ish had a couple of trees in his backyard, and everybody, realized that those are the true Esroigim, and a lot of people took from those Pardesim, and now there's many varieties of Chazon Ish. There's, in fact, Chazon Ish Esroigim now that don't even look like Chazon Ish Esroigim, because they've been, over the years, the look has changed on them, and they look like almost regular Esroigim, but there's, again, with the Chazon Ish Esroigim, the people only want the good one.
What is unique about the Chazon Ish Esroigim that's different than all the Esroigim? Man ishtana esrig hazeh mikol Esroigim.
What's unique about it is the Chazon Ish had these Esroigim in his house, they say, in his backyard, and people believe that those Esroigim are the real Bilti Morkov and the real Esroigim, so they tend to use those, and in fact, most of Lakewood uses those Esroigim. They look different. They have more skias and blitas. They in 20, 30 years ago, the gedulim were very, very schwach. Not that gedulim was schwach. It's just that there wasn't so many Esroigim on the market, so they shipped everything. Today, there's more pardesim. They make the gedulim, so they pick out only the nice gedulim and the cleanest ones, and that's what they ship to the United States.
Now, I've heard that people could pay as much as $500 or up to $1,000 for an Esreg. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, I mentioned that in the beginning. There are people that pay, upwards of $300, $400, $500, but there's not that many Esregim being sold.
And what are they
that.
Getting for $500 to $1,000? Like, what do you get for that?
You know, the Esregim have a beautiful giddle, beautiful skias and blitas, very clean. Also, we didn't mention the color. The color on the esrog is very important. It's like a diamond. You know, they compare it to a nice diamond. If the color is nice, and the color only stays for a short time. An esrog goes from green to yellow to brown, as everybody realizes. But to have it that yellow-green color, it only stays like that for a week or two. So that's why it's so difficult to get a nice esrog. Because even if it has a beautiful giddel and beautiful shkias and blethas and it's clean, but it could start turning too yellow, and then
right.
It loses the.
So the person who taught me all the halachas of esrog, etc., his name was Martcha Ludmir Zuchan Lavracha from Ludmir Zesraigim, and he used to tell me that a few days before Sukkot, if your lulav was green, you put it next to some apples and it turns yellow. Is that still the best way thing to do?
You mean the esrog?
Yeah. Put the esrog next to some apples, and that turns a yellow for Yom Tov.
Correct. So that's, by the way, 20 years ago, that's what they did. They still, and I still was in a few pardesim now when I was in Eretz Yisrael, and I saw they still use apples, and I was misspoiled, because pretty much everyone now changed to gez. It's a new modern system. In the last 15, 20 years, they put the esrogim in a small room, and depending on when the esrogim were cut, if they were cut for Shkai Deshalo, they give a little gas just to break the color. And by the way, they do this with all fruits. It's not only esrogim, it's not exclusive for esrogim, but if they were cut like later, they give a little more gas. Anything that's cut before Shkai Deshalo usually turns yellow on its own. But that's true. They still use that method. And they're small green, apples, like the small red apples, and they put them, but if you put too many, dangerous. The oxen could fall off, and the esrog could turn too yellow. So you have to really know.
So let me ask you a question. If somebody's a Yirei Shamayim and he has two choices, he could buy a really beautiful esrog with, you know, bleatis and giddel, everything right from let's say any one of these. Pick your favorite one from Badatz Chazanish. Or he could spend less and buy one Moroccan, one Yanava, one Tamani, one Chazanish. What do you think he's better off doing if he wants to be Eitz of the Mitzvah?
You really want to make sure your esrog is kosher. The cleanliness probably weighs the most.
Well, if it's a morkev, it doesn't help that it's kosher.
Right. But today again, they're not selling morkevim today.
But they don't know. How would you know if it was morkev 300 years ago? If your whole family history of your esrog is a morkev, you wouldn't know that. Which is what the Chacham Sofer says. He says the Yanav esrogim, or it's the Mishnah Berurah brings another of other opinions. So are you better off taking one Moroccan, one Yanava, one Badatz, one Tamani, one Chazanish, and say, look, I was Yaitzel Chaladeus. Or putting all your money on one and saying, I'm going to go with the Chazanish one, and if he was right, I hit it out of the park. But if not, maybe it's a Safik if I was Yaitza. What would you do?
I don't know anyone who takes five Esrogim, but I do know people that take two. They'll make a bracha on one, they'll shake on another one just to make sure that they're shaking on a kosher Esrog. Esrog and Lulav, I do know people that do that do two. But my advice is just to follow your Messiah. And to take the cleanest one. Esrogim, basically the cleanliness, if an esrog has a black dot or a hole, it could be a puzzle. But if the giddel is not as nice, or the shkias and blethas are not as nice, it's still a kosher esrog. Might not be as mahudadik. And, you know, you have to find the best one that you could. But the cleanliness probably weighs the most in the sense to make sure the esrog is a kosher esrog. As far as it not being morkov, first of all, after a few generations, they were makel, they say, that it's not such a problem. You want to make sure that the esrog is not morkov right away, like the tree. The Badatz looks at the trees to make sure. If it was morkov 500 years ago, a few hundred years ago, you'll never really know.
Rabbi Yaakov Moshe, thank you very much. It was an honor having you, okay?
Okay, thank you so much. My pleasure.
Take care, Kalta. Joining us from Chicago is Rabbi Shlomo Francis. He's for 10 years, he's learned in the Chicago community Kael by his father. He's a Talmud of Yeshiva Philadelphia. He wrote a sefer on the halachas of Erevin. And Rav Chaim Kanievsky said, you finish with Erevin, go to Sukkah. So Aguda hired him, the Daf Yomi Commission, to give shiurim on Sukkah. He became an expert on Hilcha Sukkah. Welcome, Rav Shlomo.
Thank you so much.
So talk us through, what are some of the popular shilas that as a Rav people ask about the Hilcha Sukkah?
Well, one of the things I get very often the shaila will start with, you know, there was a real shein in Mitzuya, and this happened. My mat flew off, or the walls happened, or this fell down. And I guess after getting so many shailas that are all happening with real shein in Mitzuya, you start to think, were all these wins, were these really Einu Metzuya wins? And it's really a very hard question to answer. What is Metzuya and what's not Metzuya? Metzuya is supposed to be unusual. What exactly does it mean unusual? There's no clear definition. But Moshe, he compares this to the Einu Metzuya that we find by Nezikin. By Nezikin, let's say someone puts their animals in a barn and the barn falls down to Ruach Shein Metzuya, so it's considered an Einus. He doesn't have to pay. I know if no one was going to fall down, how could I have expected in this unusual one to come, right? So based on the way Rav Moshe compares it to Nezikin, I mean, let's say a 35-mile-per-hour wind. It's a pretty strong wind, but rarely a month went by, and I researched this. You know, rarely a month goes by, not in New York, not in Chicago, without a 35-mile-per-hour wind. So is that Einu Metzuya? Is that like an Einus? And a lot of our sukkahs wouldn't necessarily stand up to a 45-mile-per-hour wind. It could, when you have that type of wind, it could gust to 45. So, you know, is that really Einu Metzuya? And this, you know, Moshe sounds like that would really be considered real Metzuya. So then you'd really have to make your sukkahs a lot stronger than a lot of our sukkahs are built. So very important thing I do feel is that people's sukkahs should be built stronger, and this is something happens all the time. The chachmats, they're very light and they catch the wind. They could often blow off. So I believe that's probably the most common issue that I've seen.
Okay, and while you're talking about it, you might as well discuss. So a guy comes home from shul on Yom Tov. He wants to make, you know, his wife's at the table. A wind came and blew the mat off, or his chach off. Is he allowed to call a guy to put it back on?
Yes, I mean, there is, you know, Shmuel Kamenetsky is not to have a guy to put it back on. It's, you know, I guess it's a tarach mitzvah, and it's considered a rai. You know, so I guess there's a big tarach for it, so, you know, that would be allowed. The question is, if you're really going to get, if it's wolf the first time, right, very likely, you know, unless it was really real Shani Metzuya, it's going to probably, whatever construction you were doing, whatever support system you have, was probably not sufficient. And, you know, if you could get a guy to say, okay, you know, please help me, my mat flew off, can you just please roll it back over? But if he's going to put the same, you know, piece of wood or something that was there the first time, it's very likely it's still in a Ruach Metzuya. It really has to be strapped down better. So, I mean, unless you're lucky, you're not going to find a handy guy who's going to really get you to redesign your schach covering in a way that will really be kosher. So this is something that really has to be anticipated before Yom Tov. I don't know how likely it is you're going to get a guy to really do a kosher job on a schach mat that blows off.
Okay, so let's say it is a case where something freaky happened, a very big wind came,
right,
and it blew off. And if you put it back on, there's a very good chance it'll stay till the rest of Yom Tov.
Right.
So the guy comes to you, knocks on your door, of Shlomo, if I don't do it, I'm not going to be able to eat in the sukkah the first 2 days. Right? So what would you tell him to do?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if that, you know, if it's really could be corrected, you know, I would tell him to have a guy. Try to do it. I mean, it's not completely Moskvim, but Shmuel Kamenetsky does say that, you know, it could be some of that is a shvus to shvus, and it's a Moskvim mitzvah, and you could have the guy, you know, replace the sach.
Right.
What
Rabbi Francis is saying, I'll just give it a little explanation, is Amir la'akam is asa. But where it's a shvus to shvus, the Moskvim mitzvah, most paiskim are matir. Right, so here it's building, it's putting something on. We'll talk about why, and it's al yedei a goy, so it's a shvus to shvus b'makom mitzvah. The question is that called a shvus putting the schach on? It's 2 days in the prima gadim. Whether he's noted to say that it is called a drabanan because it's aroy. Let's face it, sukkah is a, but then his other tzaddis, he says, since it's kavua lagabi mitzvah sukkah, maybe it's not called a rois. Maybe it's not called a shvus to shvus b'makom mitzvah. And then he's mesupik. He has another safik, I believe, whether since he says that the Tosfos sheet is that Oichel Nefesh, that Binyan for Oichel Nefesh is Mutar on Yom Tov. He says that's another tzad to be Matir. And he says he's afraid, he doesn't know what to do. He's afraid to be Matir. So it's sort of, and the Mishnah Berurah doesn't clearly say what to do either. So it's sort of up in the air whether you can. I think the Oichel is noted to do, like you say from Shmuel, that they would call a guy to do to put on the, because most Paiskim, the majority would say that it does have a Din of Shvus to Shvus to Makom Mitzvah. So give us some of the popular shilas that you get. You said one of them is wind. What else?
Yeah, no, another question is, the schach mat. You know, I know, and you know, there's a lot of different types of schach mats out there. There's this hechsher, that hechsher. And then the question is, I mean, there's a Mishnah that says you're allowed to use a mat. You're allowed to use a mat for schach. And the only issue is if it's made for shchiva, if it's meant for sleeping on, well, if it's sleeping on, then there's, and maybe it'll be mekalel tuma because a new tuma of medrash. You know, typically we say that anything that's made out of wood would be kosher as chachas, could do min aretz, it grows from the ground. The only issue might be that if it's mekalel tuma, and usually wood kalim are not mekalel tuma if you have, unless it's made into a keli. So if you have a wood spoon, a wood ladder, a wood chair, you know, that could be issues of being mekalel tuma. But if it's something that, if you have like a wood mat, which is clearly not mekalel tuma, then that should be no issue. The only possible issue would be if it's something that you sleep on. So that's the mismatch, something that you sleep, you sit, you sleep on. So that's the only issue. So this, nowadays, I mean, no mat, I've never heard of a mat being used for sleeping on, so it should be very simple. You could use a mat. So why is there all these issues with the sherim? And I do remember that there was a tumult some years ago that people were saying that, yeah, these mats, they're made in China. And in China, there are some villagers who might sleep on mats. And when I understand, the issue is not just that maybe someone sleeps on a mat. The issue is that these mats are oimi l'shchiva, and they have to be they're designated. And I can't imagine that because there's a few local people. If you have a big a factory, and the factory is manufacturing tens of thousands of mats for exports, because there are a few local people who aren't really connected to the main production of this, now would be considered oimi l'shchiva. And the place going to folks to agree with me on that. So I don't believe this was a big issue, and whatever it is, it died down. So I would tend to agree with the chazara of the tumult. So, well, what's left? Let's assume that's not the issue. So what is the issue with these chachmans? And what really boils down to is a different halacha. And this halacha is not mamish or psul. There's a halacha of maimed. Maimed is when you have something that supports, there's a halacha, that's something that supports the schach. There's a din d'rabbanan that we don't want the schach to be supported by something that's not kosher for schach. You don't want the schach to be supported by metal or plastic that's not kedumah min ha'aretz or something that's mekabel tumah. So the same way that you don't want the support beneath the schach to be something that's not possible for schach. Because people might get mixed up. They see a whole system covering my sukkah. There's metal, there's plastic. And they might think that the plastic is part of the schach, and then they come to new schach with it. So the same thing, you're not supposed to hold the schach down or tie it or secure it. That it should be unbruch metzuya, using a material that's possible of schach. So if you tie these mats are tied together with a possible material, the string that for whatever reason is possible of schach, for example, it's not to do them in aretz, any of these things will be an issue. So all these mats, they even if string that's not saying is to do them in aretz, if they have flax, the Shulchan Aruch, we discussed, if it's too processed, it's exerted or abanon, people can't tell it's a natural material. So all these mats, it seems to be like a race to have the most natural looking material, the least processed. Now, if it's a little bit processed, it won't be so bad because the whole bit of mine is not an absolute soul, and then if it's a little bit processed, it's not so clear how processed, but there's a different opinions in the Shabura, and there's no clear consensus there, but, you know, it's just to be machal. So when it comes to these mats, it seems like a race to get the most natural-looking material. So the truth is, if you go to the store, you see a mat, and you see the material holding it together is clearly not processed, so it doesn't really matter which texture it has on it. It's, you could see with your own eyes that it's clearly no issue of ma'amid, and then that's perfect to be used for schach. Now, there's other, you know, some of the mats there have a little bit more processed, and even if it's a little bit processed, you know, to use processed pishtun as schach, Mishnah says, okay, well, don't do that, but to say that I shouldn't use it for maimed, you know, it's not so clear that maimed has all these there, they're abundant, so definitely to use a little bit of processed natural fiber doesn't seem to concern us. So that's the issue with the mats. Now, there is a completely different track, you know, so a lot of the mats are there like on a race to get the most natural material. There are some mats out there that completely bypass this whole thing, and they'll tie their mats, and did some research. It seems like, and I saw this mat, it was tied together with a monofilament and plastic material. That seems to like completely, bypass this whole issue of maimed. Like everyone's trying to get the most natural, and they just go right ahead and take a monofilament plastic thread, which is clearly not kedumah in art. It doesn't grow from the ground. So what's going on over here? So after researching it seems like there's a school of thought out there that you could take the mat, put the mat on top of your sukkah, put down enough weight on top of the mat that this mat is going to be held down by the weight on top of it. You put 2x4s on top of the mat, put 2x4s under the mat. And now the mat doesn't need the string anymore. So at this point, the maimed will be your 2x4s, and it won't be the actual string that's holding the mat together. The truth is, you know, halachically, I can't say everyone, but there's a very strong support for that. If you don't need the string anymore, it's not really a maimed. You say there's 2 maimed.
Well, but Rabbi Francis, yeah. Would you say then, let's say somebody uses a maimed, he holds the schach up with a metal beam.
Right.
So would you say that it's kasha? Because if you want, you have the option of taking a wood beam, replacing the metal beam, in which case it wouldn't be held up by the metal beam. Would you say in that case it's also not a maimed?
No, so in that case, he had the option of taking out the metal beam. But at this point, the way it is right now, if you would take out the metal beam, what would happen to the shack? It would just fall right down. Or it would, you know.
Well,
so then
in this case also, if you took away the string, it would just all fall apart or fly away, and it's only the weight that keeps it.
Correct. Oh, correct. So in other words, this school of thought that is using the plastic string, they're assuming that you could put enough wood under it and over it that you can now rip the string and the wood will, and the little pieces of bamboo will stay put right where they are just from the weight on top of it and just from the support below it. So that's the assumption.
So why would that be different than metal? You could put a metal, take away the metal and put a wood under it and over it that'll support the schach.
She's saying, let's say I have a bunch of supports. Let's say I have six beams supporting my schach. Three are metal, three are wood. So I could take away the three metal and the three wood would still be there, but is that okay that I could have the three metal poles? That's what you're asking.
And right. even if they're all metal, you could bring in 16 new wood supports and say, look, snap out this, put in this, nobody ever knew. You don't care. Now it is a maimed. So if you're using it the way it is, you say, but it's going to blow away or it's going to collapse. I could put wood on top of it. Okay, you could put wood
but
on top
could,
of it.
No,
and
no,
I could put wood under the beams. And,
now, correct. Now, you're not saying that you could. If
you mean at the time, I understand. Okay.
Right. Right. So you're saying that as long as you put a lot of support below it and a lot of support
it
on top of it.
It doesn't care. So who cares? So who cares?
So who cares that there happens to be a wood thing? So now, you know, who cares that there's also this plastic string? I don't need the plastic string. It was just there to help me roll it out.
I would just say a chilek, Rabbi Francis, that a maimed means something that's supporting it. So let's say
right.
you have a metal beam. Without it, it's going to fall.
Correct.
The mat, it's there. The string is to prevent it from flying away. It's this, it's that. But it's not like without the string, it would just fall into the sukkah. So one is direct, this is the maimed. One is no. It's to prevent, after it's there, something bad for happening. So the question would be, is that also a maimed? In other words, a nail is a maimed. Without the nail, it would fall apart, right? This is secondary. It is where it is. It's going to fly away. It's going to get it's just a bunch of hair. It's going to get all tangled. Okay, for that I have the string. Is that also evident of a maimed, or is it secondary to maimed?
And so I believe they say that's far, but only after that. In other words, after you put another piece of wood on top of it, and now it's being held in place. So then they say that's sort of like what you're saying, you know, that string is not there. But if the bottom line is there's nothing else, that's clear. Everyone seems to agree that if the only thing that's holding this mat, if I don't put wood boards on top of it, I just rely on this plastic string, and I clamp down the two ends and not the middle, and then the plastic string is necessary. Everyone seems to agree that that's also called nine, because without it, it's going to fly away. Now, once
can
you put the wood on top...
I understand. Can you tie the string to the sukkah? Can you tie with a string that's not makabel tuma? Could you tie down your mat?
So most places can say yes, and it's almost l'ferishner mechaber, but there is one sheet out there, and I don't really understand it, that says, but I believe most, you know, said that you shouldn't tie down a mat with string because it makes it like a ticker, it makes it like a roof. But I don't believe that's acceptable.
So I'll tell you, my sister Hayimi, I was in Eretz Yisrael, and I was living next to Diane Fisher, and I asked him this question, and he said, it's a l'ferishner teisvis on sukkah on the Beis Amar Aleph. Taisa says that why is Geshem B'chag considered a klola? Put very heavy boards on, put boards on, and the rain won't be able to come through. So Taisa
right.
says because you need a diras arai and not a diras kva, and if you do it in a way that, in such a way, it's called already a diras kva. So he said because of that, you would not be able to tie it down, it would give it a din of a diras kva, according to Taisa. Taisa says,
put it down with masmerim. That's kavur. That's clear.
She says because you need beinan schach arai, and if you do it in such a way, it has a din of kva. So you can't do it so that it doesn't. The nak shamim yard b'taychay has a din. You're creating it into a kva. It's a din of kfa by sukkah. So he said,
right.
if the schach is not mobile, if it's attached, it would have a din of keva, and you can't. So he
right.
said, Lamashal. And by the way, I was in Eretz Yisrael in Rav Gusman Zuchan Lebrachas Shul. and they had over there the schach, where they it's like an outdoor porch, and it's a type of a gazebo where they don't nail in the boards, but they put them into these like channels, into these like, you know, carved out rivets, and they put in that it mamish can't move. And I wouldn't make a brach in the stuff. He was there. I don't know if this was after this tier. I'm talking about a few years ago. I was there, and I told the guys. I said, "You can't make a brach in the sukkah. Why? Because l'chayre at that point it has a din of kvar." And I, you know, obviously everybody in the shul disagreed with me. But this is what Rav Fisher told me. And I actually asked him, "Could you make a sukkah on a boat and tie it down?" And he said, "No, it'd be problem because of this." So it was just an interesting.
I understand, but the kvar is something that's, you know, discussed whether you're shining, but now nailing down is mesmer being kvar. You know, a lot of places can hold that tying it down is not an issue. So Kamenetsky says that that's just tying because it's not the derech. A lot of other places can also say that it's not the derech to make a tikra out of string. So a lot of places can hold just tying down the mat. It doesn't have an issue of kvar. The question is, what are you tying it down with? So a lot of the mats come with some extra fibers. You could tie it down using their natural fibers so that the maimid won't have an issue of maimid with the Avraham Kabbal Tumah. So they give you extra natural fibers. So that would be pretty most places can hold that's fine. And the mats come that way. They come with the extra fibers. You could tie it down. And it's important to tie it down this way. You don't have it. It doesn't have an issue of Meruach Mitzuyah. You know, what I was saying before was that there is a school of thought out there that you could just use a plastic string for the mat. And what I found, and a friend of mine tried it, like he got one of these mats and he put wood on top, wood on bottom, and then he cut the strings. And within a few minutes, the little teeny pieces, they sag, they go sideways, up, and they were gone within a few minutes. They were not Ein Baruch Mitzvah. So, you know, I had another friend who tried it in Phoenix, and he says he's sure that it would work, maybe in Phoenix where there's no wind, but I would be very, very skeptical of trying to make a contraption that really solidly can hold down a mat not using those things. So I would really recommend if someone is using a mat, and they want to be, you know, mat is not completely likuva. So it's only, some people can't get over mat, they have a metal frame, they can't figure out, you know, how to lift their schach off the metal frame. You really should be put some two-way fours on top of it, but not everyone knows how to do all that. So if someone's not being machmir on maimed, fine, but you really should be. The Mishnah Berurah says, because they usually machmir for it. So in that case, people should really spend the extra few dollars and get a mat that has a natural fiber. Now, whichever heksher doesn't really matter. As long as you can see that it's a natural fiber, then you know that they're being machmir for that halacha maimed.
What about going on vacations? You know, people want to go to Great Adventure on Purim or in Eretz Yisrael. They want to go out to the banyas, and they're going to spend the whole day and they're not going to be able to eat in the sukkah. Are you allowed to be moitzi yourself from mitzvah sukkah?
The truth is, you know, it seems like there is a little bit of a minig that people don't do that. They try to be machmir to eat in sukkah even when they're on vacation, even though they're on big trips. Now, there's two things here. First of all, what's considered a trek? You know, at what point do they consider a halchei derech? Right? It's not just all in tchum. Shmuel kind of gives a gather that somebody he said that it's, if someone would call it a trip. Now, I think I'm not sure if I really have any more direction after here than after that, but apparently if it's very close, it's something that you just go and come back and, you know, you still consider near your house, then there's for sure no door feeding a sukkah. Now, you know, I've always grown up that, you know, in these trips that we take home, no matter what, where we make sure to get a sukkah. And just based on the true information, I do think it is somewhat accepted. Ramesh says that it's not considered, you don't have the tool of halachei derech if you're going on just a pleasure trip. It's not, doesn't really count as a halachei derech.
Which, by the way, Ramesh is very mechudish because the Shulchan Aruch puts no parameters on it. It says halachei drachim, Purim and Asukah. Ramesh says, no, it has to be dafka for a tzairach, like parnasa or mitzvah, this, that. If you're just going for a teal, that's not called halachei drachim. None of the paiskim that precede Ramesh, and I mean, this Gemara is, you know, a few thousand, 2,000 years old, say this. So it is a very big chiddush.
Yes, correct. And you know, it always bothered me because it's not mentioned that way. And just the opposite, it sounds like once you're halchei derech, the reason is not because like it's a b'diavad, it's just once you're halchei derech, people leave their house and then they don't, there's a kashya thing to do. You're supposed to keep your sukkah like your house. It's normal to people go on trips and they don't necessarily make an effort to stay near their house because they should be able to eat by their house. So the same thing, you could go on a trip and do it. And you know, so that always bothered me in Shmuel Kamenetsky, like he was bothered in the same way. That you shouldn't be going on this trip. Now, You know, so it definitely seems like there's a good makom lahakol, but I do feel that it seems like this was somewhat accepted, this tract of Ramesh, even though it's mechudesh dik. So I'm not necessarily saying that it shouldn't be fallow, but definitely for ketanim. And the truth is, it's for adults, it's very easy, usually should be pretty simple to avoid it. There's a lot of, you know, nowadays most of our meals on her bed anyways, you could eat a pretty decent meal out of your sukkah without washing, without having a real chiyuv sukkah. So maybe you wouldn't like to eat a full meal with, you know, meat and potatoes out of your sukkah in your house, but if you're on a trip, that's for sure okay. And again, you know, one of the questions is exactly what's defined as a trip, you know, what's considered far enough.
So here's the shaila, okay? On one hand, you're saying, look, let's not be maker, let's be machmer.
Right.
On the other hand, there's a musig of simchas yamtes. So if all the kids, they say, we want to go to Great Adventure, and the father says, I'm sorry, we can't go to Great Adventures because of the mitzvah sukkah. So he's arguably being memayit in Simchas Yamtis, right? And he's arguably not even going to be makayim mitzvah sukkah because that achil is not teshvu kein tederu. So it's funny, right? When on one hand a chumra turns into a kula. Let's be memayit in Simchas Yamtis. Let's do something that we ordinarily would not do. The Seovar Sarf Sternberg brings from the Aderis. He used to be makbid never to leave his sukkah, the whole sukkah. Until the Aderis himself said, I think I'm making a mistake. Because the mitzvah sukkah is teshvu kein tederu. If I'm living in my sukkah in an unnatural way, I'm not being mekayim teshvu kein tederu in the sukkah. Interestingly. So it's like a lot of times in halacha, a kula one way, a chumra turns into a kula. You know, so, and I saw Rav Sternberg take a rise. You, because of Simchas Yamtiv, you should take your kids on the trip. He brings Ramesha, he disagrees with Ramesha. You know, and you're saying you could eat, you say, we're going to go, we're not going to eat any hamaitzi. Well, maybe you're being mamayin and Simchas Yamtiv. The kids come home a whole day, you know, I'm not on Atkins. You know what I mean? So, so I'm saying Ramesh's psak is his psak, but yeah. I'm saying Ramesh's psak is umkayme munach and Ramesh's al paisik, but I'm just pointing out the other side of this. Let me share with you an interesting story. I'm curious. When I was in yeshiva, there were a few boys that built a sukkah. We always used to build a sukkah on the roof of the yeshiva. So a few guys built a sukkah, four guys got together, and one guy snored terribly. So they told him, we want you to leave the sukkah. And he said, no, I chipped in. They said, good, but you're staring while I was asleep. So they went, and I remember this a long time ago. They went to Reb Shlomo Zalman, supposedly, and they had a din Torah. And these guys said, look, we want him out. He's snoring. We can't go to sleep. And this guy said, very lamdisha thing. He said, when I go to sleep, I'm a chayiv in sukkah. When I start snoring, they are pata from sukkah because they become a mitztayer. And they're Oynis Rachman Apatre, right? So if I can't, let them leave the sukkah because they're pata at that point, and I'm a chayiv.
Uh-huh. Well, you could have said the other way, that, look, if you're going to snore and you're going to bother everyone else, so then you would leave if you keep waking up.
He's saying, Fakert, you're pater from the mitzvah when I snore. I'm a chayiv in the mitzvah. Since I'm a chayiv in the mitzvah, you should leave. I shouldn't leave.
Uh-huh. And then he could also say he should leave to accommodate. That might also be true. Yeah. To accommodate everyone else.
But his point is, I'm not allowed to accommodate you if you're pater from the mitzvah, and I'm a chayiv in the mitzvah.
Because as soon as I snore, you'll be pater to go.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay.
Interesting,
okay.
Shaila. So Rav Shlomo Zalman supposedly told the boys, maybe he's right, Kenzayin Ezegerech, but once he's sleeping, at that point he's pater min ha-mitzvah, so carry him out of the sukkah, because he's pater, and then you go to sleep, and you're a chayiv in the mitzvah.
Really? So he held that way in general, or just because
he held that since a yashan is potim and a mitzvah,
so the ones who sleep,
carry him out, and you guys go to sleep, because he was right. So the Velt argued asked under Shlomo Zalman. They said, we don't make a bracha to sleep in the sukkah. Why? Because I forgot which of the paiskim says why. Because you don't know you're gonna fall asleep. See, that's why you don't make a The shaila is, why do you make a bracha amapel? You don't know if you're going to fall asleep.
Okay, it's in the Indian of sleep. It's not necessary.
So the Velt says, because mapel is hamapel chedleshena, who makes my eyes heavy, it's about going to sleep. Even if you don't fall asleep, you still make hamapel. Whereas the mitzvah shina sukkah is not about going to sleep. The mitzvah is sleeping in the sukkah, and you don't know if you're going to sleep, so therefore can't make the bracha. So the Velt tying it, or maybe this guy tying it. So you see from this, if I can't, mitzvah sukkah is sleeping in the sukkah, even when I'm not aware, that's where I don't make a bracha. The mitzvah is not a mapel, the mitzvah is the sleeping. So if that's the mitzvah, I'm not an oinus like all other mitzvahs, that is this mitzvah. So if that's the case, you can't carry me out of the sukkah.
The mitzvah is to sleep.
Yeah. So you can't say carry him out at that point, he's not being mekayim the mitzvah. That is his kiyum mitzvah, to be without das, to sleep. And that's why he doesn't make a bracha, because it's not the falling asleep, it's the actual sleeping. So therefore, you can't carry me out. I don't remember how weird it ended. I just thought it was a very Chikava Maisa.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, there is such a tumble in Halacha Maisa, just in general, because if you don't have enough space, you have a small sukkah, you don't have enough for all your kids. So you'll tell them once they fall asleep, you'll carry them out. And I know it's very questioned if that's the Mahalach. Same idea.
What would you say, Rabbi Francis? The guy was walking down the street, he wants to eat in a pizza store, and they have one of these pop-up sukkahs. It's in Rosh Hashanah, right? It's open. It's a big opening. There's no doorway there. There's no way anybody's sleeping in such a sukkah in the middle of Manhattan or whatever it is, 13th Avenue, with the door, no door with people passing. We know the Mordechai says a sukkah has to be roi for all the mitzvahs hayayim. Since this is not a sukkah that's roi l'shina, could you eat pizza in that sukkah? Or do you say, look, you're not mekayim mitzvah sukkah and you shouldn't buy pizza there?
Yeah, I mean, we had that question years back when I was a bacher. So there was like a shooting around the block from my house, and my father was saying, okay, we can't sleep in the sukkah. We were all a bit shaken up. So I said, well, listen, we can't sleep there, then we can't eat there either. It seems like people, again, it is a little bit schwer, but it does seem that at the end of the day, we are naive to eat in sukkahs that people that are theoretically right for sleeping, there's people are scared to sleep there. So it does seem that we somehow have gotten past that issue, even though it is a kasha. It does sound like an issue. Now, my concern with, these pop-up sukkahs, again, I had a neighbor who put up a pop-up sukkah right next to his house. Now, supposedly, if you tie them down right, it's not supposed to happen. But over sukkahs, it fell down a bunch of times. And over 7 days, literally every other day, it fell down again. So, and I would strongly question how the feasibility of making these pop-up sukkahs in a way that's really a baruch mitzvah. I mean, the whole thing doesn't, the whole thing weighs a couple pounds, and with the schach mat, I would question, I would definitely want to look at the engineering and how it's tied down and all those things to make sure it's really a baruch mitzvah, because that's a real psul. And not only that, people don't realize this, when a lot of times you could have a sukkah right next to a big building, and it's shielded from the wind. Now, halacha is that we look at the baruch mitzvah, according to most paiskim, we look at it as if it's in an open field. So I don't believe it's very possible to make one of these real light sukkahs the Baruch Mitzvah if it's not being shielded from the wind, even if it is shielded. I'm talking about when my backyard, my neighbor, it had three sides. It had three or four story buildings on three out of the four sides, and it still came down a couple times over one sukkah. So that's my main concern with these type of sukkahs is if they're really able to be Baruch Mitzvah. That would be my concern.
And then our Royal Shiva. Rabbi Francis,
right.
Thank you very much for your time. It's an honor to be speaking to you.
Yes, thank you.
Helta. Bye-bye.